Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Donald Trump's remark in an interview today that the U.S. has fallen behind on nuclear weapons capacity and that we're going to be at the top of the pack. William Hartung, director of the Arms and Initiative Program at the Center for International Policy and the author of The Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex, joins us to discuss the enormous spending spree Trump is about to embark on by throwing money at the military-industrial complex in additional military spending yet to be defined and making America great again by going back to a Cold War nuclear arms race with the Russians. We will assess what the strategy is behind wasting more money on the Pentagon and the DOE's nuclear weapons modernization plans, as well as blowing billions on a wall on the Mexican border. Is this a repeat of the Reagan strategy to ramp up defense spending to blow up the deficit in order to foreclose all other domestic spending and force cuts on Medicare and Social Security? Then we'll speak with Washington-based journalist Adele Stan, who is a weekly columnist for The American Prospect. She has been at today's Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, and we will get an update on the speeches by Betsy DeVos and the joint appearance by Reince Priebus and Stephen Bannon, where the alleged power behind the throne, Bannon, attacked the press as the enemy in a battle that is, quote, going to get worse, while telling the gathering of right-wing movers and shakers that Trump has their backs and he was maniacally focused on delivering on his campaign promises. Then finally, we'll examine the frosty meeting that took place in Mexico City today between Secretary of State Tillerson and Mexico's Foreign Minister and Interior Secretary, where concerns were raised about the human rights of Mexicans living in the United States facing deportation. Shannon O'Neill, a senior fellow for Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of Two Nations Indivisible, Mexico, the United States, and the Road Ahead, joins us to discuss the contrast between Tillerson's conciliatory tone and Trump's fighting words today about kicking out, quote, really bad dudes in what he called a, quote, military operation. And joining us now is William Hartung, director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the Center for International Policy. His books include Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War, and Prophets of War, that's P-R-O-P-H-E-T-S, of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Hartung.
Yes, thanks for having me.
And the military-industrial complex is poised to get a huge gift from Donald Trump in unspecified amounts of additional spending. We don't know exactly what the strategy or the purpose is, but he says he's going to that we've fallen behind and he's going to throw money at them at the Pentagon. But today in an interview with Reuters, he said he's also going to that we've fallen behind on nuclear weapons capacity and that we're never going to fall behind and that we're going to be, quote, at the top of the pack. So there's another, that means the DOE gets showered with money along with the Pentagon. So how different would this be from, say, Barack Obama's $1 trillion nuclear modernization program?
Well, I think that's the interesting thing is I think Trump has no idea of how much they're already planning to spend. You know, $1 trillion over 3 decades to build new ballistic missile submarines, new bombers, new land-based missiles, new cruise missiles, whole new generation of nuclear warheads. I'm not sure what he's going to increase. I mean, you know, he could do things like, you know, he could break out of the New START treaty. He could build more warheads, even though there's huge overkill. He could start nuclear testing. I mean, there's things he could do that would go beyond the existing buildup. But I feel fairly certain that it hasn't sunk into him that we're already in the midst of a huge nuclear buildup.
But it seems that more than anything, what he's driven by is either campaign promises or by this knee-jerk idea that anything that Obama did was bad. And that apparently happened in his phone call with Putin, where Putin brought up the New START treaty, and first of all, Trump didn't know what Putin was talking about and had an aside with his aides, and then they explained to him what it was, and this was a deal that Obama had made, and then he gets back on the phone and says, oh, it's a bad deal.
Exactly. So
anything that Obama did is a bad deal, and I'm going to make a different deal, whether it makes any sense or not. Is that's where we're at?
Yeah, because it's, you know, he did it with the Iran deal, he's done it with New Start, all the trade deals. You know, the trade deals, I think, could have been done differently or better, but I don't think Trump's going to make them better. And on the other issues, he's just working from emotion, as far as I can tell. You know, as you said, well, Obama did it, then it's a bad deal, I can make a better deal. And he seems to forget that there's two sides to these deals, you know, and that the deals that he's criticizing took a long time to negotiate and are actually fine. I mean, the Iran deal makes it harder for them to get back into the nuclear business for 10 to 15 years, including extra inspections. New START, both sides are inspected, same level of warheads. If anything, it's too modest in terms of the reductions that it you know, implements. But the idea that you're going to rip these things up and come up with something better, I think is absurd, you know.
Well, I think the important context here for this conversation, William Hartung, is that the U.S. has about 6,800 nuclear weapons and the Russians have 7,000. Now, I don't remember what the last count was of the Chinese, but I think actually the French might actually have surpassed the Chinese, and certainly the Pakistanis, their arsenal is growing faster than anybody's on the planet, and that's a very unstable country, which leads you to some serious questions about nuclear proliferation and the use of state terrorism under the nuclear umbrella, which is Pakistani state government policy. So that's scary in itself, but it's a somewhat different conversation. But the point I wanted to make was that the Chinese have maintained a fairly low level of deterrence in what seems to be a much more rational approach, is that you got just enough nuclear weapons to make sure that nobody's crazy enough to attack you. So, and what is that, about 250 or 300?
Yes, and in fact, there were some analysts at a couple of the war colleges who did an analysis a couple of years ago, and they said for purposes of deterring another country from attacking the United States with nuclear weapons, you would need 311. Now, how they got to be that precise, I have no idea. But anyway, in the range of 300 versus the 6,000 or so you've mentioned. So there's no military or other value in building more nuclear weapons. And I mean, even if you want to blow up the world, you've got more than enough than you need. So it's entirely symbolic, not to mention a huge waste of money. But the fact that Trump feels he has to do it, I think, is problematic in its own right, because it's further evidence of how ignorant he is on these subjects.
And again, I'm speaking with William Hartung, who's the director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the Center for International Policy. His books include Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War, and Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. But just in terms of the absurdity of building more nuclear weapons, which I think is, you know, pretty clear, and the case is there, the numbers are pretty clear, 6,800 on our side, 7,000 on the Russian side, you need only 311, the Chinese have roughly about that, and yet Trump is talking about us being on the top of the pack. So whatever Russia does, we're going to do more, and that's the dynamic that goes back to the Cold War. So we're talking about a new Cold War nuclear arms race, aren't we?
Yes. Assuming Trump, you know, says the same thing tomorrow that he said today. I mean, he's been all over the map on this. You know, in the campaign he said we should nuke ISIS, which means he doesn't know what a nuclear weapon is, because obviously if you nuke ISIS, you would kill hundreds of thousands of millions of civilians. Then he said at one point, well, maybe we can kind of deal with the Russian, you know, we'll take off sanctions over Ukraine and maybe we'll reduce nukes. Now we've got this thing about staying on the top. So, you know, it's hard to know, but it's clear that in his kind of, you know, not fully developed mind, more is better. And especially if he can show he's the one who, you know, brought us more. So that's, I think, the danger. And it's not clear there's a lot of cool heads around him to rein that in. I know a lot of people hold out great hope for the generals, Mattis and McMaster and the rest, as being more realist than Bannon and company. And I think that's true, but they're still extreme hawks. You know, so it's not like we have great choices in this administration.
And of course, he also in his interview today with in the Oval Office with Reuters, Trump said, "We're very angry with North Korea because of its recent ballistic missile test," and said he's accelerating missile defense systems for Japan and South Korea. But, you know, North Korea maybe has, what, 10, 15, maximum 20 weapons. The fact that we've got 6,800 and they've got maximum of 20 doesn't seem to be scaring the North Koreans, right? I mean, he did say that the Chinese could fix the situation, and the Chinese have cut off their coal imports from North Korea. So it appears for the first time they're actually seriously annoyed with the North Koreans. But in general, that's always been the problem, hasn't it? How can anybody, the big guys like the US and Russia, preach to the small guys that you can't have nuclear weapons? We've got them coming out of our ears.
Exactly. There's a colleague whose name I'm forgetting, who has a piece in Foreign Policy about Iran, and he's got this quote from an Iranian leader saying, "Well, France gets to have nuclear weapons, and the United States gets to have nuclear weapons. Why can't Iran have nuclear weapons?" And it was the Shah of Iran saying this. So, this issue goes quite a ways back. And for some countries, it's kind of this notion of being part of the club, you know, the sort of prestige, its power, and so forth. And so if the biggest players are building up further, then it may open up other avenues of proliferation. Also, if they ring China with missile defense systems, the Chinese are not going to be entirely convinced that they're targeted at North Korea. And since they have a fairly small number of warheads, they may fear at some point that the U.S. could do a first strike and, you know, mop up their 100 or so, missiles and warheads with missile defense. Next thing you know, the Chinese might get back in the nuclear arms racing game. You know, so there's no upsides to Trump's idea.
Well, given that, you know, Trump's sort of off on doing his own thing and it's hard to follow him, and some people think that Pence is actually running the government along with Ryan and McConnell, and they're very happy to have Trump in the White House. He's brought them power. So there's some sense that they're running the government as much as anybody is. But how much is this then just Republican policy? Because, you know, if you go back to Reagan did a huge uptick in arms, threw a ton of money at the Pentagon and at the nuclear weapons DOE, and that blew out the deficit. And the tactic has been to foreclose the possibility of domestic spending. And, you know, Ryan and company want to go after Social Security and Medicare, and if you blow out the budget and blow up the deficit, then there's your excuse. Is that what's going on here? Because on top of the stupid throwing more money at the Pentagon, when we spend more money than I think just about 10 or 20 countries combined, and most of them are our allies, and then you throw all this extra money at the nuclear weapons industries, and then you throw, God knows, 20, 30 billion at this stupid wall, which is a total waste of money. Is that what the real strategy is here?
Well, I think if there is a strategy, that is it. I mean, it's kind of, I called it in one thing that I wrote, Reaganomics on steroids, because it has the same outlines, military buildup, huge tax cut, and some assumption that it's all going to work out, which, of course, it doesn't. Reagan was eventually beaten back in various ways, but he did a lot of damage in the meantime, and I think he set the table for a much more diminished domestic social safety net than had existed before, including things like slashing public housing. So I think that seems to be what's playing out, and unfortunately, Trump seems to, or somebody in his circles, seem to be quite enamored of some of these proposals by the Heritage Foundation, which, of course, is funded not only by right-wing foundations, but also by defense contractors. And so he's signed on to their Pentagon buildup, and at least according to his speeches, you know, 350-ship Navy and tens of thousands of new Army and Marines, and bulk up the Air Force, expand the nuclear buildup, however that is possible, a more robust Star Wars system. So one analyst puts that at probably an extra trillion over 10 years, on top of the enormous amounts the Pentagon's already slated to get. And then on the domestic side, there's plans for tremendously deep cuts. And, you know, they just revealed Trump's initial hit list of agencies he wants to get rid of. And they're relatively small. I think a lot of the impetus is ideological. You know, defund Planned Parenthood, kill the National Endowments for the Arts and Humanities, get rid of Corporation for Public Broadcasting. It was pointed out by somebody that all the things he wants to get rid of cost about $2.5 billion per year in total. And the Pentagon, by the accounting of its own Defense Business Board, wastes 10 times that every year just on excess bureaucracy. So, you know, there's a kind of a ideology about how they're restructuring the budget, but there's also a the reality that there's just programs that Republicans have hated for decades. I mean, Newt Gingrich wanted to get rid of this stuff, and Reagan wanted to get rid of some of it, and they're finally found their moment that they think they can get that done, but it has nothing to do with balancing the books, you know.
Well, if you go ahead and do what they plan to do, it will have those consequences for sure. And that's what I wonder is, at the end of the day, is there any pushback? Because the Democrats have always gone along with the military-industrial complex too. I mean, that's a part of Eisenhower in the first draft of his farewell address referred to the military-industrial congressional complex, and he took out the congressional indifference to the Congress. But that's what it's all about, isn't it? The Congress are the ones that write the checks.
Yes. I mean, in the last 5 years, the Pentagon's gotten less than it wanted to because of the budget caps and the Tea Partiers and such. And so they feel that they're entitled to more. Of course, even under that scenario where they didn't get everything they wanted, the budget's at about $600 billion a year, which is higher than the peak of Reagan's buildup. So they have enormous amounts of money, but they feel cheated because under their plan of a few years ago, they would have had substantially more than that. And whenever they talk about that they're suffering deep cuts, they're cuts compared to that fantasy budget, not cuts compared to, you know, what's being spent year to year. And the Congress, so these budget caps in the Pentagon have held because of a kind of a left-right coalition. The Tea Partiers like the caps as long as they're kept on domestic as well as Pentagon spending. The Democrats don't want to lift the caps unless they're lifted on domestic as well as Pentagon spending. So there was this gridlock. Now, that could change with a Republican Congress and a Republican president, but there haven't been Democrats standing up and saying, oh, yes, let's cut the Pentagon budget. So in that sense, we're at a significant disadvantage. I mean, if some of these things come with cuts in other areas that are particularly distasteful to Democrats, then perhaps they may try to block some things in the Senate. Likewise, if he really goes off the deep end on the deficit, you know, some of the fiscal conservatives will push back. But I think the problem is those things will take time. You know, he can do a lot of damage before you could rally effective opposition in Congress, you know.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, William Hartung, you've got Mattis at Defense, and you've got the new National Security Advisor, General McMaster, and you've got the other general at Homeland Security. And most of them come out of the military experience, and particularly special forces, or at least an understanding that the wars today involve special forces, not these ridiculous weapon systems like the F-35 and all that stuff that you can't really use in these subnational and transnational wars that the U.S. has been embroiled in since the end of the Cold War. So is there any restraint coming from those guys, from the generals, saying, you know, we don't need this stuff in the wars of today and tomorrow?
I haven't seen it yet. It could still emerge. And, you know, the early returns, I mean, it's hard to believe this person's only been in power for 4 or 5 weeks. But, you know, in the early going, the Bannonites have outmaneuvered the cabinet members on a lot of issues. And they've made boneheaded mistakes that the generals have tried to modestly fix. But they may well do that because I think, you know, they're war fighters for good or ill. And so I think they do understand, as you said, that some of these things are completely irrelevant to the wars they're likely to fight. I mean, my concern, in addition to the money, is they're these sort of can-do people, you know. I mean, you know, McMaster fought in the 91 Gulf War, which was a rout, and he was part of, you know, creating the surge, which is a very overrated, you know, initiative, but nonetheless seems to have some sort of iconic status in certain circles. So, you know, on the other hand, he wrote a pretty interesting book, kind of a searing indictment of the Vietnam War and all its various consequences. But in terms of his combat experience, he views himself as a winner, even though I don't think we've, you know, necessarily won anything in these wars of this century. But so anyway, I'm a little concerned that, you know, he's a smart guy, he'll figure out a war plan that'll quote-unquote work, and that on that, in that respect, could be even more dangerous than some of these clowns like Flynn and Bannon. You know.
Well, William Hartung, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with William Hartung, who's director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the Center for International Policy, and his books include Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War, and Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin, and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about today's CPAC conference.
But the atoms here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military atom, like who gets there firstest with the mostest atoms. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They got to get together or disintegrate. A whole less truth to be self-evident that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Adele Stan, who's a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specialized on covering the intersection of religion and politics and has extensively covered the conservative movement in the Tea Party. She's currently a weekly columnist for the American Prospect, where she has an article, Milo and the Moral Corruption of the Conservative Movement. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adele Stan.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And of course, the Milo that you refer to is the provocative right-wing troll who right. went a bridge too far in terms of his outrageous trolling.
Milo Yiannopoulos, who was, you know, suddenly on the CPAC agenda. That was a surprise, right? Last Saturday that was announced, and then by Sunday he was off when people further to his right started promoting a video of a radio program he had done back in January of 2016, where he said that, you know, it can be a good thing for a 13-year-old to be involved with, for a 13-year-old boy to be sexually involved with a grown man.
Well, that's pushing the bounds of liberty, isn't it, I suppose? Or libertarianism.
Yeah, if you don't believe in an age of consent, you know.
Right, right. So you've been covering the CPAC, and Stephen Bannon and Reince Priebus made a joint appearance to show that they were really getting on well. I take it that you haven't been able to get back in because of Pence is about to speak there, and they've changed the rules, and it's a complete screw-up, and all the press have basically waiting in line, and it sort of makes you wonder. I thought these are the guys that make the trains run on time.
Well, you know, it's funny that you use that phrase, because at one point in his the attempt by Priebus and Bannon to put on display, you know, their buddy-buddy relationship, which by all accounts does not exist, so that he liked Reince because, you know, Reince was low-key, gets things done, and then he goes, and he makes the trains, and then he stopped because he must have suddenly realized that perhaps not the entire C-SPAN viewing audience, you know, liked El Duce, because that's a quote from, you know, that's what was always said about Mussolini, that he made the trains run on time, and that's how he maintained power.
So, but Bannon's really, the thing that I find extraordinary is that most politicians make ridiculous promises on the campaign trail.
Right.
Which they, and they do it because they want to get votes. And you stir up the mob and rile them up and they vote for you and then you forget what you promised. Most of the time you make ridiculous, exaggerated and unrealistic promises. Now, nobody has made more ridiculous, unrealistic promises than Donald Trump, including building this wall. But
right.
What Bannon said today is that we have your back, but you've got to go after us and make sure that we deliver on all of our promises and that Donald Trump is focused in a maniacal way. That's what he said, on delivering on his promises. So tell me about it. You were there to see this. I mean, what was that about?
Well, you know, I would like to remind everybody that, you know, a focus, you know, somebody who's maniacally focused is still a maniac. I mean, you know, a focused maniac is still a maniac. And you're right in that these promises, while so preposterous, I mean, Bannon is, you know, bent on proving that they can deliver on these things, or at least, you know, attempt to in ways that are totally disruptive, because that is what he does and what he wants. You know, his philosophical underpinnings are all about, you know, destruction, so something beautiful can rise from the ashes. So it was really quite extraordinary to hear him tell, you know, the conservatives that they had to hold the administration's feet to the fire, and that's because they're not all Bannonites. So he was, you know, really making a play for his faction. There's two factions, right, in the Trump White House. There's the Koch faction, the Koch brothers, you know, people who have been, you know, friends, either part of the Koch network or whose careers are owed to the Koch network, and Reince Priebus is one of those people. And then you have Bannon, who is not really of those circles, and who is, you know, more attuned to the id of Trump. And you have his circle, the Breitbart circle. So you kind of have this tension between the Koch wing, which Betsy DeVos is part of that, and the Breitbart wing.
Well, perhaps another way to put it is that you have the Koch wing with Reince Priebus, and there are a number of proteges, like the EPA guy is also a protege of the Trumps, but also
right, and the speaker of the House is,
more importantly, the Vice President Pence.
Right, exactly.
So there's a lot of them, and then the other way to frame, perhaps to frame the Breitbart faction, the Bannon faction, is that they are another billionaires faction. They were all funded by the Mercers. Who funded them when he was funding, and they all worked for Ted Cruz. And then when they saw the writing on the wall that Ted Cruz was going to go down, Bannon and Kellyanne Conway jumped ship with the Mercers and got behind Trump, and the Mercers became Trump's biggest backer. And apparently there's a close relationship with Rebecca Mercer and Jared Kushner. They're very bonded over being Likudnik's supporters of Netanyahu. So is that a better way to frame it? Or?
Well, that is. That is, in a sense, a way to crystallize kind of these two competing factions that both, I want to stress, and it rarely gets stressed, both of these factions are all about privately held corporations and the money that they are able to wield, because they have such little in the way of regulation and transparency. So both of these factions are part of a culture that believes in opacity, you know, in keeping things, you know, under wraps. That's the culture from which they come. They're all private capitalists.
You mentioned Betsy DeVos. Tell me, how did her speech go down? Didn't she make some, she made some kind of inference, did she not, that she wasn't totally happy with the bathroom nonsense that the Trumps have turned around and undone one of, yet another one of Obama's initiatives?
Yeah, so well, that was the news this morning before, you know, she took the stage at CPAC. But it was noted by noted in the queer press that she managed to never mention the word transgender while she was expressing that disappointment.
Well, that's a pretty big word, you know.
But of course, course, she did, you know, she from the stage, she did the usual Betsy DeVos rap with, for school choice. She misnamed the president of the American Federation of Teachers, with whom she's supposed to go on a couple of school visits, and that's Randy Weingarten. She called her Weingartner. And she, you know, ostensibly, I mean, she basically, you know, did what we would expect her to do. She just made a big case for school choice. And the whole obfuscation that they say, well, shouldn't every student be able to access the best education, which they do by giving these vouchers, which comes out of public school dollars. And, of course, they're not enough to cover the full tuition at a private institution, leaving poor kids with no use for those vouchers and then stuck in schools that have been essentially robbed of what should be their budget.
So in terms of the takeaway from Bannon, it seems that much of what's being reported is where Bannon talked about ushering in a new political order. And, you know, previously he'd referred to the press as the main opposition, which...
Yeah, he did today, too, from the stage, the opposition
right.
party. Yeah,
right. And he basically says that they're sort of globalists and corporatists, which is pretty extraordinary coming from the Trump administration, who've just nominated another corporatist to the Supreme Court and to join the corporatist in charge of the Supreme Court.
Right.
So, you know, that's where they... And they wouldn't be the majority party, but for Citizens United, which is a ruling that favors corporations. So I'm not sure about the depth of his opposition to corporatism. But certainly globalism, I suppose, is tied in with the idea that you're all losing your jobs and they're being shipped.
Well, and I think the corporatism, I mean, when they talk about corporatism, they're talking about publicly traded corporations. And I know that seems like a fine point, but it's not. You know, they're talking about corporations that are traded, whose shares are traded, you know, publicly on the exchanges. And they don't see themselves in the same boat.
So what's going on in terms of these two universes we're in? You've got some of the press, the New York Times, the Post, the LA Times doing really good work, and the Wall Street Journal, even though Murdoch owns it, to expose what Trump's up to. And then you've got the alternative universe where Donald Trump is more popular with Republicans than Ronald Reagan was at the same time. It has a massive population, 85% roughly, support. And Ronald Reagan didn't even have that support. So, you know, you have to pinch yourself and remind yourself that most of the country opposes him, and he got 300 fewer votes than Hillary Clinton did. But
right.
he's absolutely solid with Republicans. And that's why I think it's on Bannon's being clever by making the press the enemy, because they're the only people who can make him accountable. The Democrats,
right.
Democrats just don't have the numbers to make them accountable or stop their agenda as much as they can try.
And dare I say, Ian, that is right out of Vladimir Putin's playbook. If you know, PEN America did a terrific report in 2014 about how Vladimir Putin has, you know, used and abused the media, and it's you know, and one of the things is, you know, to couch any kind of, you know, the kind of reporting you're talking about where that would hold leaders accountable, to couch it as fake news. I mean, that is right out of the Putin playbook.
So that leads me to a question that I have, a broader question is, why are progressives in this country asleep at the switch, and particularly the political left, and the further to the left you go, the more they support Putin?
Right.
And Jill Stein, and who was sitting at the table with Putin and General Flynn for the big RT gala in Moscow back in 2015. So there is this, you know, strange denial about what's happening in terms of a global, you know, compact amongst authoritarians and neo-fascists, and a creeping fascism that's happening around the world. And it could, things could really change in Europe if the far right get in France. It could be the end of the Europe. Wilders, the fascist leader in Holland, is ahead in the polls. So something is hideous is happening. And we already, history already shows us that there was too much appeasement, too much blindness to the rise of Hitler. And without, you know, throwing the word fascist around irresponsibly, which often happens on the left, you know, there are these historical examples and there are some clear and present dangers that are emerging. You know, if there's a godfather of the global illiberal movement, it's Vladimir Putin.
Right.
He's a small fry, but if he's managed to get his guy in the White House, then you really got to take him seriously, and you've got to take this idea of the global rise of fascism seriously. So why are people not more concerned on the political left?
I think that that the trouble with, you know, for people on the, you know, the further ends of the left is the fact that Putin granted Snowden asylum, and Snowden being a great hero of the left, to condemn Putin is, you know, that's problematic there. There's also, there seems to be, I mean, do they understand that, you know, that this is not the Soviet Union, it's not even pretending to be socialist, that it's, you know, just an outright authoritarian kleptocracy? I don't know. I think that there is a tendency when you get further to the ends of either the right or the left to have a certain embrace of authoritarianism, of the strong white male leader. And there has always been this problem of sexism and racism on the left, just as there is in society. And I have, you know, found that the people who, you know, people who are likely to troll me are often people to my left who are white males, you know, on Twitter or whatever. I mean, that's not scientific. But it is curious. And I wish I could tell you I have the definitive answer for that appeal. I don't, other than the fact that when, you know, that RT has long been an outlet for you know, progressive commentators. I mean, I confess to having appeared many times on Tom Hartman's show, which appears on RT. I no longer do. You know, Putin has courted the U.S. left in this way.
But the one thing that Putin and Trump and particularly Bannon have in common is white ethno-nationalism. And that ought to get people's attention. I mean, I know they
kicked, one would hope, right?
Well, they kicked this Spencer guy out of CPAC, right?
Oh, but wait a minute. You know, that whole thing, and, you know, an enterprising young reporter, Olivia Nuzzi, N-U-Z-Z-I, check out her Twitter feed, because, I mean, she made the point that, yeah, they kicked him out after he was allowed to hold court with reporters for 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it wasn't like, you know, he was shoved out the door the minute he tried to get in.
I see.
He accomplished, they allowed him to accomplish what he needed to accomplish.
Well, that leads me to this general kind of question about Trump's ambivalence when it comes to white nationalists. It took Trump forever to repudiate David Duke. And then he did so incredibly reluctantly and in a very perfunctory way. And it took him a long time, Trump, to even acknowledge these anti-Semitic actions and desecrations of cemeteries and attacks on synagogues around the country, which are growing at an alarming rate. And he was asked by a Israeli journalist and by an Orthodox journalist here in the United States.
Right.
And he was incredibly rude to the Orthodox guy and doesn't answer these questions. And obviously had to make a public statement about the rise of anti-Semitism in the United States coming from these same Spencer types, you know, that they seem to be playing footsie with in this kind of under-the-table way. And finally, he comes out with a statement, obviously not spontaneous, but forced.
Oh, yes, I think that's really true. I mean, I think he knows that, you know, here's the thing, Ian. At the root of conservatism, and Trump is not a conservative, in the traditional sense, but at the root of conservatism is something that is crafted to look like an ideology wrapped around, you know, a sort of nugget of, you know, of racism and sexism. Truly, that's really what conservatism is. The ideology is crafted to, you know, justify leaving people out of the social compact. And so what Trump essentially did was he unwrapped it. He unwrapped it. He understood that that's what fueled the conservative movement. He also understood that it really didn't need the ideology anymore. If you could stoke up, you know, the core, the molten core, you can fuel your own thing with it. And that's exactly what he's doing. And so, no, you know, there probably aren't enough avowed white nationalists or neo-Nazis or Klan members, you know, to get him elected or keep him in power, but those people are mouthpieces for, you know, resentments that people who would never identify themselves that way also feel, and it gives license to the expression of that. And Trumpism is all about resentment.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Adele. I hope you get back into the CPAC and get to see...
I'll be there tomorrow to see the president.
I'll see the... Well, yeah, you're going to miss Vice President Pence, but...
I'll watch him on C-SPAN. Great yes. to be with you,
Thank
Ian.
You so much. And again, I've been speaking with Adele Stan, who's a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics and has covered the conservative movement and the Tea Party for a number of years. And she's currently a weekly columnist for The American Prospect, where she has an article, Milo and the Moral Corruption of the Conservative Movement. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the frosty meeting that took place in Mexico City today between Secretary of State Tillerson and Mexico's Foreign Minister and Interior Secretary.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way of saying goodbye. I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
You taught me everything I know. About taking other people for a ride. And I just wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
Nos manejan mal.
Dame, 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 dame todo el power para que te demos en la madre. Gimme, 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 gimme todo el poder so I can come around to joder. Dame, 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 dame.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Shannon O'Neill, who's a senior fellow for Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, where she specializes in U.S.-Latin American relations, trade, energy, and immigration. And she's the author of Two Nations Indivisible, Mexico, the United States, and the Road Ahead. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shannon O'Neill.
Thanks so much. Nice to be with you.
Well, thank you, Shannon. And there's kind of a mixed message coming from the Trump administration. The Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, is in Mexico City meeting with Mexico's Interior Secretary and Foreign Minister. And obviously there's some tensions that they're trying to deal with between the two countries. But at the same time, Donald Trump is meeting with manufacturers in the White House, and he's saying to them, there's some really bad dudes, referring to Mexico, and saying that this deportation plan underway is a military operation. And then he went on to say, because we have to be treated fairly by Mexico. So where does that idea come from, this sort of beleaguered idea that Uncle Sam is Uncle Sucker and somehow other countries push us around? But even the country next door, I would have thought the Mexicans feel that they're overshadowed by the colossus of the North.
Well, it's a very different perception. As you say, Mexico many times has felt that it has suffered from the space that the United States takes up, and also the power that the United States takes up in the negotiations that we have with that country over many, many issues of economics, of commerce, issues of immigration and the movement of people, issues of security, of the border, of the environment, of shared water sources, of all sorts of issues. So the Mexicans feel that way. And what's really new on the U.S. side is the sense that's come from Trump, unlike many of his predecessors, whether Republicans or Democrats, that the United States is the one that's getting the raw end of the deal, and Mexico is the one holding the power. And so that dynamic is very different than we've seen before. And some of the, frankly, hostility in Trump's language towards Mexico, both in the campaign and in these first several days of the administration, have set the relationship on edge precisely because of that. The idea that both of us, or both countries, are losers from the interactions between the two is something very different in our relationship.
So when Secretary of State Tillerson said there's no mistaking that the rule of law matters on both sides of our border, and he pledged to work with Mexico to stem the flow of cash and weapons from the U.S., I've often wondered why in that relationship where we talk about how Mexico is beset by crime, et cetera, and drug kingpins can break out of jail, et cetera, and very little focus is put on the reality that the reason that there's drug trafficking is that there's a massive market here in the United States that where the consumers, that's where all the money, the drug money comes from. It comes from the United States. So our hands aren't entirely clean. And, of course, recognizing that cash and firearms head south also seems to be at least an acknowledgement that in the so-called war on drugs, it's not all Mexico's fault.
Well, and that's right. It is not all Mexico's fault. And as we think about this war on drugs or even the movement of drugs in the Western Hemisphere, the United States is the largest consumer market for illegal drugs in the world. And this is really a situation of demand and supply that is meeting it. What we did see in the remarks of Secretary of State Tillerson today was a recognition of U.S. guns going south and being part of the violence. And that is something we saw during the Obama administration as well. So that is, again, a continuation of U.S.-Mexico policy, quite different from the words that his boss, that President Trump, has been using vis-a-vis Mexico and the challenges of security there.
So where does the Merida initiative stand then? I believe the State Department has given Mexico about $2.6 billion since 2008 to strengthen the rule of law, counter narcotics, support judicial reforms, and police professionalization.
Right now, the administration have said that they're doing a fundamental review of all security assistance or all assistance in general from the United States to Mexico. And the Merida Initiative is the largest part of that. Several years, somewhere between $200 and $300 million a year going to Mexico for various operations there, for these trainings, for cooperation, for support for their security efforts. That will be under review, and many people are thinking that this review and the money there might be replaced, so no longer sent for Merida Initiative type of efforts, this training and the like, but used as a way to pay for this wall that Trump wants to build.
Well, that's the amazing thing, surely, Shannon O'Neill, is that politicians often make promises on the campaign trail in order to get votes. It's a well-worn tradition. But the idea that you would make sort of somewhat bizarre promises on the campaign trail and feel obliged to keep every one of them, even if it's completely impractical and unrealistic and unnecessary. Stephen Bannon doubled down at the CPAC conference today in Washington, D.C., saying that, actually exhorting the conservative crowd to sort of, we have your back, but you've got to push us. We're going to institute the entire agenda. We're going to do everything we promised. Donald Trump has a maniacal focus on fulfilling all of his campaign pledges. So is this being done for those reasons, or is there some reality behind the idea that you have to fulfill campaign promises?
Look at historical studies of what politicians do when they come into office. And most politicians actually try to fulfill a good portion of their campaign promises, a majority of their campaign promises. Sometimes it doesn't just promises for votes, sometimes because the context changes and it no longer makes sense. So Trump wanting to fulfill his campaign promises isn't all that different than than past presidents. The difference is that some of these campaign promises are quite extreme, and many aren't based in sort of deep-seated knowledge and expertise in people who have thought a lot about the larger ramifications of these types of efforts. And here, building the wall is one of those. If you talk to border security experts, the $20 billion or more that it will cost to build the wall could be used much more effectively for the types of things he would like to do, for stopping the problems that might come in from across our borders, than actually building a wall. So I think the challenge here with many of Trump's promises is, while they're politically very popular, they don't make a lot of sense in reaching his ultimate goals.
And 10,000 more ICE agents, and I can't remember what the exact figure was in terms of Border Patrol, but my understanding is that Border Patrol and ICE are by far the biggest law enforcement agencies in the United States, and their budget outstrips everybody else. You think that's going to happen, whether it's realistic or not, that money's going to be spent? And particularly the $20 to $30 billion that this wall's going to cost.
Well, that would increase the Border Patrol by some 50% if you brought in those numbers of people. Mm-hmm. In surges in the past and the numbers of personnel along the border, it's actually been a doubling of those numbers to 20,000 people over the last decade or so. So we've seen that happen before. If you talk to people along the border, you go and talk to Border Patrol, the challenge isn't so much people in the spaces in between the ports of entry where people can cross over the border. Those are actually quite controlled. A lot of the challenges are at the actual ports, and how do you facilitate the movement of goods and the ones that are legal goods while also diminishing or stopping the movement of illegal goods. And that actually has less about Border Patrol and is much more about customs. That's a different profile than at least it seems we're talking about with this new 10,000.
So is there any, apart from the sort of somewhat frosty relationship that the diplomats are trying to deal with, both the Interior Secretary in Mexico and the Foreign Secretary spoke, and obviously Tillerson was doing the best he could, but it's pretty clear that they're not too happy. Indeed, the Mexican officials are concerned about the human rights of Mexicans living here in the United States. And it does feel like we are going through a completely different period in terms of our attitude to immigrants. And the news reports from the people that are being rounded up now does sound somewhat cruel, particularly when you consider, on the one hand, the DACA kids, the Dreamers are going to be protected because Donald Trump says he likes kids, but their parents might well be deported. And that, obviously, losing your parents is not exactly kind. So what do you think is going on here in terms of how real that is and how much that impacts Mexico in terms of just at a human level? Obviously, you know, we look upon Mexico as having its own problems with corruption and disappearances of students and stuff. But on the other hand, it does seem that these feelings are quite deep across the border in terms of just human dignity and national pride.
Well, I think there's two big challenges with the way the Trump immigration policy has been laid out so far. And the first is this idea that you would root out the Mexicans that are here. There's probably 5 million undocumented Mexicans that are here. Many of have been here for well over a decade. Many who are the parents to U.S. citizens. The estimations are over 20 million U.S. citizens have an undocumented parent. So you're ripping apart these families and you're sending them back to Mexico, to somewhere where many of them have not lived or even visited for a decade or a couple decades. So all of a sudden you have a challenge of a potential surge of people coming back who no longer really have connections to your country, frankly, right? And their much stronger connections are to the United States. So that's one big challenge for Mexico and an affront to the Mexican people and to, you know, the hardworking family nature of many of the people that they would be, that the United States would be sending back. The second real challenge for Mexico, another affront to their sovereignty and their dignity, is that in these edicts that have come out over the last couple of days, is the idea that the United States would, anyone who crossed the U.S.-Mexico border coming up to the United States illegally, any of those people, whatever country they came from, if they came from China or Haiti or a Central American nation or others, would be sent back to Mexico to await their asylum process or others. And that Mexico was sort of a dumping ground for people from all other nations, which is against Mexico's interests. It's not their people, and they would say it's not our problem. It's the United States that should be dealing with their own asylum process, not forcing Mexico to take care of these people while the United States immigration system slowly goes to work. So I think on both sides, Mexican sovereignty has in many ways been affronted, and hence we see the very tense relations and discussions that happen today.
So I remember reading a piece recently from the former Mexican Foreign Minister, Castaneda, who suggested that if it comes down to a kind of confrontation between the Trump administration and Mexico, and we know, I think, you know, it was pretty strange the way that Donald Trump treated Peña Nieto, the president, because Peña Nieto clearly helped Trump out during the campaign by hosting that impromptu meeting where Donald Trump was able to appear to have foreign policy credentials. And then subsequent phone calls, et cetera, did not go well along the lines of the phone call to the Australian Prime Minister. So what Castaneda was arguing is that if things get really tough, and, you know, they start butting heads, these two neighboring countries, Mexico has a lot of leverage. We talked earlier about the Merida deal. That largely helps the United States, I should think. And then on the other hand, I understand that Mexico itself cooperates with the U.S. by trying to stop Central Americans from entering the United States or even entering Mexico by patrolling that border that they have with Guatemala.
There are some things Mexico can do and leverage that it has in the sense that cooperation with Mexico and between Mexico and the United States has been very helpful for the United States. It's helpful for security reasons. Mexico shares a lot of intelligence that they get in terms of people who might be suspected terrorists or others who pass through their other borders nearby. It helps in terms of immigration flows into the United States. Mexico has been very helpful over the last couple of years in stopping the flow of Central American migrants. There's some 300,000 to 400,000 Central Americans who have been leaving their countries every year, most of them heading north. And Mexico has stopped many of them at their southern border and deported them back. Those people never reached the southern U.S. border. And we never had the challenges that we had in 2014 when there was a rush of particularly young people, kids who were coming across seeking asylum. So Mexico has been very helpful on that side. Mexico is also, despite some of the claims of Trump and others in his administration, the economic ties, the commercial ties between Mexico and the United States help create jobs in the United States. The estimates are some 5 million jobs here. And really, they make whole industries globally competitive in ways that they wouldn't be if they just were based here in the United States. So all of those are things that Mexico has some leverage. But Mexico also has to remember, it's a much smaller economy. It's a much less powerful political country around the world, and it depends more on the United States than, frankly, the United States depends on it. So even if it does have leverage, it needs to find a balance so that it doesn't hurt its own interests.
Well, Shannon O'Neill, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Shannon O'Neill, who's a senior fellow for Latin American Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, where she specializes in U.S.-Latin American relations, trade, energy, and immigration. And she's the author of Two Nations, Indivisible, Mexico, the United States, and The Road Ahead. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.